Welcome back. We have a wandering mic, so we'll ask if anyone has any questions to wait until the microphone reaches you so that then people can hear the question and also that the question can get recorded as well as the answers. So please do feel most welcome to ask any questions that you have on this particular theme. And don't worry about your questions being stupid or bad or what they will think about your question. I encourage everyone to recognize that they don't really exist. But, so please feel welcome to ask whatever you would like. Yes, there's the fellow in the front row there.
Thank you, John. You mentioned your thesis, which had the word Protestant work ethic in it.
Protestant work ethic.
Yes, that's right. And you mentioned the Brooklyn Father. I lived in Germany for many years, where I encountered the Protestant work ethic. I went out with a girl from Brooklyn who sounded like the father, and we had discussions about, career and that type of thing. How would you defend yourself, let's say, in a discussion with someone who simply does not believe in what you're saying in that way, with the middle ground between success and failure? What would you say to them?
The Buddhist approach is not, so much arguing with people, but just reflecting on your own experience. So that, say, for my own experience of achieving things or succeeding at things, just seeing how, yes, you can have won the prizes. You can be someone who is sort of doing well. But yet feel a sense of great worthlessness and insecurity within you. And so that was one of the things that encouraged me into the monastic life, was because not so much in terms of achievements, but I saw that numerous times when I was in my late teens, early 20s, how I could be in situations where everything was like sort of picture book perfect. You're sitting by the riverbank under the weeping willows, picnic, good friends, sunny England in summertime on a beautiful day. It's just like the dream, or on a tropical beach, like in the old Bounty adverts, palm trees, warm seas, and a perfect situation, and yet be completely miserable. Like inside feeling insecure and hollow and very unsatisfied, sick at heart. And it was really striking to me that, because I'd look around and think, well, there are all these beautiful people in this perfect situation, and everything is, it can't get any better than this. And yet, why am I not happy? And just seeing that the external circumstances didn't make any difference. Almost sometimes made it worse, that you couldn't blame it on the weather or that difficult person. So I would refer to personal experience and say, okay, well, when you've got the things that you want, or you're providing for your family, are your family happy all of the time? Are you really satisfied with the results of all of your work? How does it make you feel? What is the sense of well-being that comes within you or around you, how consistent is that? How does that really fill the heart? And just asking people. And if their experience is, well, I feel great, it's good, my family are fantastic, I love them all the time, they love me, well, sātu, great, good for you. Long may it last. Because you're coming from an individual's own experience. If I come to you and say, you should see it like me, then I'm missing the point. But I can only speak from my own experience. And then just seeing how going back to the psychology department, so I looked at the people who are my lecturers. They were dear people, but I thought after studying psychology for 30 or 40 years, they don't actually seem a lot happier than I am, and I'm not very happy. They've been working on the mind and studying the mind in this very, that's their career. how come they still seem to be a bit, you know, neurotic and insecure and moody and fragile? And, and so that was one of the things that motivated me was, well, it's obviously not just an academic understanding or having some good experiments to prove something, you know, that makes a difference. And also, you know, one of the opportunities that I had was that my godfather is a partner of De Beers Diamonds Corporation, Raymond Oppenheimer, cousin of Harry Oppenheimer, who's the king of South Africa, and the head of De Beers. So I had an open door at De Beers when I was growing up, and the deal was if I got a university degree, then I would have a walk-in at De Beers Diamonds. And but then I see my godfather with, you know, an extremely posh house in White Waltham in near Maidenhead, two Rolls Royces, RO1 and RO2, and he was not a happy man. He's got everything. He never had to work, just sort of sat back and collected the money. He was a sleeping partner, so he didn't do any work, just collected the money, and he was not a happy man. So that when you got those examples right in front of you, and say, well, if you're a person, you know, hardworking Brooklynite or diligent German Protestant, say, well, good for you, but what is the actual result from your own experience? And you know, if they want to hold on to that and say, well, it's good, it's fine, this is perfect, okay. You know, may it be so, but also I think it's just helping people to be honest about where the shortcomings are, rather than just repeating a party line like, well, I've decided this is the good life and so it is. And well, if that's your experience as well as just your ideal, well, sadhu, good for you. But is that really the whole story? Yeah, this one there.
Thank you, Venerable Sir. I just want to reassure you that your presentation was a real success.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Score another one.
100 out of 100. Venerable Sir, going back to your reference that you made to De Beers, I deal a bit with the global corporate sector and the whole issue of the entire economies of the world are based on achievement and success and economic success. What are the ways, or are there ways through which, for instance, the world Buddhist community could play a role in bringing some of these values into the forefront of global thinking? Because you are connected with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the other Buddhist leaders across the world. What are the ways that can be done to bring about alternative ways of measuring success?
That's a very good question. Funnily enough, I was sitting down last week with a couple of people from Ashridge Management College, Ashridge Business School, it calls itself now, and planning the possibilities of doing a conference on compassion and leadership, sort of a collaboration between Ashridge and possibly Amravati as an organization in Italy called Consciousness, Mindfulness, Compassion, that's arranged a few conferences that I've been part of, and possibly also the Oxford Mindfulness Center. And so the people at Ashridge, I was interested to hear from them that the idea of ethics in leadership and management is now sort of taken for granted as what is a necessary part of any success in the business realm, but also is heading that way, that mindful activity and the developing a mindful life is moving heavily in that direction towards it. To succeed in the business world, mindfulness helps, and that there are various sort of studies and programs that I acknowledge that they're mostly focused on the bottom line, how much profit is being made, but also along with the bottom line profit being made, the quality of well-being that is also being promoted along the way. Another friend of mine, also who was teaching at Ashridge, just dropped in, and his whole field now is teaching mindfulness and meditation in business and academic circles. And he said he spent the day with a head of a merchant bank, a finance corporation in the city, and the person was discussing with him about what kind of mindfulness could do with his staff. And he said, and this fellow is the head of a merchant bank. He didn't say which one, but he said, I don't care about what effect this has on the bottom line. I just want the people who work for me to walk out of the office and see a person on the street, a homeless person on the street, and to genuinely care about the welfare of that person. That's what I want. So can your program help that to happen? And so this fellow, Michael, was saying, yes. But he was absolutely sincere. So it to me that the there's very wholesome currents moving in the world. And so I think making these kind of connections with places like Ashridge and promoting the not just Buddha's teachings, but also the mindfulness practices that are getting more and more popular and common, promoting those, because they also have, even if they what they want is more improvement in the bottom line, that along the way they get some surprising results. The well-being of the people and also the value system of the people can change along the way. So some people, like a few years ago, some friends of mine in the States were criticized for doing a meditation weekend with some of the administrators from Monsanto, who are a global corporation very heavily involved in genetic engineering and rigging crops to have no, so the seed only goes for one lifespan, and you can't regrow the seed after the one crop. They have to keep buying new seed from them. So they were criticized for even talking to Monsanto, like they're the sort of incarnation of evil. But then they said, but at the end of the weekend, one or two people saying, that was really, really useful. Don't tell my boss, but I'm considering a career change. So there are unexpected beneficial circumstances, both by people leaving corporations, but also changing the culture within corporations. I mean, even just to hear that the head of some bank in the city is more concerned about the well-being of a homeless person, and he said, seemingly absolutely genuine, that he said, I don't care about the bottom line. I don't care about increased productivity. What I want is to have the workforce, the people who work with me, to have more of a quality of humanity, to be more humane and have a greater humanity. So, well, sadhu. So the more that we can promote dialogue and inter kind of friendly exchange, and also make the resources available to people, then the more that will filter through the system. So that even though you do have many shadow sides of globalization and capitalism, that those powers being used in skillful ways can have a very, very big effect. One person who's in a very powerful position, who's got a wholesome motivation, can have a big effect on a lot of people. And that's kind of how the Buddha operated. He shortly after his enlightenment, so after having met the local spiritual heads, the Kassapa brothers, and then the Kassapas and all of their disciples becoming disciples of the Buddha, then he went back to see King Bimbisara, and Bimbisara became his disciple. And then shortly after, King Pasenadi became his disciple. So he got the kings on his side. And there were the kings being his King Pasenadi, King Bimbisara, having become the Buddha's students. Then that trickles down through all the people that they are governing. So that within Buddhist tradition, you do have that recognition of the top-down effect. But if you have a person who's in a powerful position, who has got a skillful motivation, well, good for them. A number of years ago, I was in Detroit, and a friend of ours who used to come to these Sunday talks and Saturday meditation workshops, he got to know Amravati because he was on a year's contract here in England helping to rescue rovers at the time, when it could have been rescued. And so he got familiar with this community, and when he went back to the States, he was located in Detroit. And so before he left, he said, well, you're going to California every year, Ajahn. Would you ever consider visiting Detroit? And I thought, Detroit? Dharma life in Detroit? You know, is there any Buddhist groups there? You know, it's a sort of industrial city, and I didn't think of it as a Buddhist place at all. But of course, sure enough, there's local Buddhist groups, and I said, okay, well, if you can want to invite me and set up some events, I'll come along. So Detroit became a regular stop on my sort of Buddhist tours of the U.S. And he had worked for Goodyear's. He used to run the advertising campaigns for Goodyear's. And he knew Bill Ford, who was at the time looked after the charity side of the Ford Motor Company. And Bill Ford is now the head of up to recently, the head of Ford Motor Company. So anyway, he said, look, Bill Ford, you'll be surprised, but he is really interested in Buddhism and meditation. So would you be open to meeting him? Sure. Okay. No problem. So I went to this extremely posh house. You expect this, a great grandson of Henry Ford, and so there was Bill Ford and his family, had his wife and four kids, and so he started talking to me, and he was saying, you know, I'm really I don't belong in corporate America. This is a really an awful world, and it's like a life in the shark pool. It's really ghastly, and you know, really what I want is to sort of to move to Vermont and just bring my kids up in the forest and kind of grow vegetables. And don't you think that's a good idea? I'm paraphrasing a bit, but not much. And I was kind of surprised to hear what I said, which was, well, you know, I'm a forest monk, so I can relate to the idea of going off to live in the woods, and can completely sympathize with that. But, you know, you're obviously a very good-hearted person, and you are a Ford. And you are in the middle of this very powerful organization. So why don't you consider, rather than just stepping out of it, why don't you consider trying to change it a bit and being a good influence from the inside? And we went back and forth, because he wasn't very pleased to hear that, especially coming from a monk who he thought was going to affirm his view about giving it all up. But anyway, he ended up staying with the company, and then because he was a very good-hearted person, very kind, and like when there was a big accident, a disaster at the Rouge River plant, and he went straight to the plant after this big fire, and people were killed and injured, and they kept saying, "Look, you can't, you know, you're one of the bosses, you can't go to the accident site." And he said, "I'm going. These are my people. I'm looking. I care for them." And so very, very noble and good-hearted person. So eventually they ended up, even though at the time he was sort of sidelined in the charity section, because he was so good-hearted and trustworthy, they ended up making him the CEO for quite some time. And he did do quite a lot to try and make Ford a more eco-friendly and humane company to the degree that he could, while still keeping it profitable. And so it was, and not that he necessarily followed my advice, but I was really pleased to see that he was staying within because he saw that he could have a big influence from being in the middle of things, even though there was a lot of shortcomings, that there was a good influence that could be brought to bear. So in terms of the work that we do, even if you're in a very powerful position, like you're head of government or head of a corporation or you're running a university or something, even though it's there might be a lot of stress or a lot of there's a lot of weight that your name carries or the post is very prestigious, I wouldn't say that has to be an obstacle. Even though the Buddha said, you know, gains and honor and fame, they're vile, they're bitter, they're obstructive. You have to make your own judgments, but I think in certain situations, it's really worth staying with the corporation, with the institution, and doing what you can to benefit it from inside. Because if all the good people leave, then what are you left with? It's much harder to have a wholesome and noble influence if all the good-hearted people feel they can't stay. But rather, it can have a greatly supportive and beneficial, change of values. Anyway, that's my not very humble opinion. Yes, in the front there.
Thank you, Sadhu, for this talk. Appreciate it very much. I just wanted to say, from my sort of background, I was wondering what sort of advice you'd give to somebody who, when we do Dāne and try and that sort of framework of mind of thinking in terms of we want to gain merits, and what advice would you try and give to somebody who has that sort of framework of mind of wanting to gain, to when we give to sadhus or to lay people, what sort of advice would you give to change that framework or abolish or reduce that sort of conditioning of thinking in terms of, from my sort of background, I'm not dragged, but I'm taken to
is that your mother?
like Dānes and stuff like that, mm-hmm. in Sri Lanka, Australia, here. And a lot of my sort of family, they think if we do this, you know, you're going to get something from it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how to explain that I'm not doing it because I want that. Just want to do it because it's a nice thing to do. Mm-hmm. But how would you change that perception or that conditioning?
That's a very good question. In essence, it's what the passage I read from the Lumpur Cha Dhamma talk was addressing somewhat, because it's very, very common. I'm sure it's the same in Sri Lanka, very much in Thailand, that people go to the monastery and a huge amount of the support is coming from people trying to get merit, punya. It's a kind of celestial bank account that you're kind of racking up the units for your fire insurance. So that, in your next life, the idea is that you're scoring lots of points so that you'll get it's a really good retirement plan, and you're insured against the fires down below and such like. But it's a very childlike mentality. I mean, it's natural enough and it's harmless enough. And the Buddha was a genius insofar as that even though he knew that people do get materialistic and they do get superstitious, at least nothing's getting killed or damaged in order for people to make merit. You're not sort of feeding, like the idea of sacrificing animals to make merit or killing infidels to make merit. You know, that it's the first precept is panatipata, don't kill anything. And so that even if things are misunderstood or taken in a very worldly or superficial way, it's at the very best, it's there's benefit that's being done and very little harm. So that's important to have that sense as well. I think if the mentality of, we're going to make some merit, or we're going to get a lot of merit from this, just first of all to notice that mentality arising, like, here's the gaining mind doing its thing, me getting something. And then, just as you described, to then reflect, well, who is there to get anything? Yeah, that sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas are not self. So who's there to get anything? And sabbe sankhara anicca, all things are impermanent, so you couldn't keep it anyway. Even if there was somebody to keep it, it couldn't be kept because all things are impermanent. So that way of keeping things in a perspective through that active consideration, investigation, and looking at that attitude, examining it. Also, there's other teachings that come to mind. The Buddha, there's a sutta called the Velamika Sutta, where the Buddha talks about It's quite sort of long and detailed discourse that he gives. And he says, in a previous life, I was a Brahmin in this city of Velama. And I was incredibly rich. And I made this huge offering one time, which was 84,000 silver pots filled with gold, 84,000 gold pots filled with silver, 84,000 horses, 84,000 elephants. It's this massive, incredibly valuable offering. And he said, even though the wholesome karma, the punya that came from that huge offering was great, such an amount of punya, of blessings, of merit, that's not as much as comes from keeping the five precepts. Just to take the five precepts and keep the five precepts for a day and a night is far more meritorious than making an offer of like 10 billion pounds or 100 billion. Pounds, that it far outweighs that. And they said, and even more meritorious than keeping the precepts for a day and a night is to practice loving kindness for the time that it takes to milk a cow. This is the abbreviated version of the sutta, because we've got many, many different layers. So practicing loving kindness for the time it takes to milk a cow, which is about 20 minutes. and said, even more punya than practicing loving kindness is to maintain the insight into impermanence for a finger snap. So just to truly see anicca, to see the uncertainty of things, to see that all things are empty and transient, to truly see that is more meritorious than that gigantic material offering. So those are really important suttas. To bear in mind that the Buddha says it's to develop the insight into anicca, into uncertainty, into change. There's more punya in that than filling up 15 truckfuls of offerings to bring to the monastery. We've got a 30-year building program here that's going to cost a lot of money. Right? And so that if someone says, how much is it going to cost you, Ajahn Amaro, to build this? And, well, it's 8,000 square meters of buildings. That's probably about 20 million pounds plus over the next 30 years. Okay, 20 was it? Or would 25 be a little extra, would that help? Okay. But and you think, well, that's very generous of you, Sadhu. But I would say there'll be more merit, more punya, in keeping the five precepts for a day than writing a check for 25 million quid. Really? And similarly, to genuinely see into anicca, just to really know that all things are insubstantial, uncertain, impermanent. There's more, in a sense, that the powerful good karma is much greater. Just to see that. So even if you know those teachings and really take those to heart, that has an effect. So that when you are making all those useful offerings and bringing, I'm not encouraging people not to bring things to the monastery. We've got about a lot of hungry mouths here. So please keep the potatoes coming in. And it's appreciated. But it's really important, just as Lumpo Cha is pointing out. And over and over again, people would come to the monastery to kind of tambun or make merit. He said they come in, they sort of stream out of the tour buses, and they come and make their offerings, and they stream out again. He said, I've only just got to the, I just recited Namo Tassara, and then they're gone. They can't even wait to hear a 5-minute Dhamma talk, and they're so busy making merit, they don't even know what they're looking for, really. So that sense of listening to those teachings, getting a feeling for what punya really is. What is that? That the quality of genuine wisdom outweighs even the most enormous kind of amisa dana, like the material offering. What is that? How does that work? And why would that be more valuable, a quality on an individual level? Why is that more precious? Why is that more? Even if you can't kind of understand it, or you can't really see it directly, you can't get a feeling for it, even just knowing those teachings. And say, well, look at that. Now, that's what it says in the teachings. Now, how does that work? Or, how could that be? Or what's my feeling for that? So to just really let that into the heart, so then it changes the perspective. Another really useful teaching is where the lay disciple Visakha, who was a very significant character, she was one of the Buddha's main supporters in Savatthi, and so she helped build the monastery of the Eastern Park, and she was a supporter of the Sangha for many, many years. And so one time she asked the Buddha, I'd like to ask for 8 favors from you. And the Buddha said, tell me, what are these favors that you would like from me? And so Visakha said, well, what I would like is when there is a monk or a nun who is sick, I'd like to be able to provide food, especially for the sick monk or nun. And when you have a nun or a monk who is sick, then there's usually a monk or a nun who is their attendant, who's looking after them, who's nursing them because they're unwell. So when you have a nun or a monk who's nursing another one, they haven't really got time to go out and arms around. And when somebody's sick, they often have to be at the bedside the whole time. So I'd also like to provide food for the nursing monks and nuns. I'd like to be able to do that. And then in the rainy season, then I'd like to be able to provide bathing cloths for the monks community, for the nuns community, so that when the rainy season comes, then they can cover themselves when they go to bathe in the river, and they can wash their robes, and they've got things to cover themselves up with. And when there's a monk that's newly arrived in Savatthi, or a nun, when some nuns have come to Savatthi, I would like to particularly provide food for the newly arrived monks and nuns. Because if they've just come to Savatthi, maybe they've come to Savatthi for the first time, and they don't know the routes to walk around. They don't know the streets and their way around Savatthi. So they might set out from the Jetavana or from the Bhikkhuni Upasayang, and they don't know the way to go. So they'll get lost, they won't find the people who want to offer food, and they'll go back to the monastery and they'll be hungry. So I'd like to provide food for the newly arrived nuns and monks. And the Buddha said, so she listed all these 8 things. So the Buddha said, so Visakha, what advantage do you see? You know, what benefit do you see in providing these things? And she said, well, because he's sort of fishing to see, okay, what's your motivation here? I'm going to make a lot of good karma and then I'm going to go to heaven, you know. Well, what's her motivation? So she said, well, when I see some monks or nuns arriving, then I know they're going to be eating my food. Or when I hear that a certain monk is sick, you know, I'll know, oh, that monk is being looked after. I'm sure he's got the food he needs. And his nurse has got the food he needs as well. So, then when I think of those things, then that will bring gladness to my heart. When my heart is glad, then my body will be relaxed. When my heart is glad, my body is relaxed, that means that it will be easy for my mind to concentrate. When my mind is concentrated, then it's much easier for insight and wisdom to arise. He says, good, Visakha, very good. This is a very suitable motivation, so I grant you your 8 favors. So again, that's really useful teaching to bear in mind. That it's not just because they would be useful things. You know, she was a rich woman; she could provide a lot, and so. But he wanted to know what's the motivation or what the what's your thinking behind asking for this, and with that he saw that what she's really guided by is that. Not just helping others, but also helping herself and helping herself in the best way, not for some imagined future goal, but just seeing here and now how that those mind states that are most skillful and beneficial, that are really liberating, are directly supported. So just hearing those teachings and bearing them in mind, then when your mom or your dad says, come on, let's go to the monastery and make some punya karma, you go, okay. Well, yeah, I'm happy to come along, but also, why don't we sign up for that retreat and make even more punya karma? It's also another thing that people can, I don't know how it is in Sri Lanka, but in Thailand, people can be very superstitious about punya, about boon. And so they, when they like they get fired from a job, or they get bored with a job, or they say someone is in the monastery and they say, oh, I want to leave the monastery, and they'd say, well, because my merit has run out. So, mot bun is the Thai expression. Mot bun, my merit has run out. That's why I've got to go. I can't. What they really mean is I can't stand it anymore. I'm bored with this, and I'm fed up. And say, oh, mot bun. And then so Ajahn Chah would just say, well, make some more. If your merit has run out, make some more. You know, it's not difficult. Just go back to your kuti and make some more merit. You know. But we can be very superstitious about, well, it's all the merit we're running on is from the past life. And so that we actually disempower ourselves because we think, oh, my merit's run out, or I haven't got enough merit, or if I had more merit. Just like yesterday, somebody came and said, we're talking, it was actually the same group was asking about desire. And he said, well, you know, it's not in some people's destiny to become monks. And I said, it's not a matter of destiny. There's no Pali word for destiny that the Buddha praised. So it's choices. Like it's your choice. You can choose to become a monk or not. It's not destiny. You know, if you want to make that choice, the choice is available. So people, I think in terms of decision making and such, it's also one of the most valuable things with Buddha Dhamma is that it puts the responsibility back in our hands. We're not victims of past karma. We're not just running on what's happened in a past life. If you pay attention to the Buddha's teachings, like this life, this is the one that matters. This is where we can make a big difference. So it's the choices we make now, rather than thinking, oh, well, I've got so many obstacles from past lives, I can't really. It's too difficult. Or, yeah. I can't manage it. One of the most wonderful things of the Buddha's teaching is that he's saying, if you don't like the karma, the result in karma you've got, make some fresh. You know? the choices we make today, now, that's what is the thing that is the deciding factor. And we, out of superstition, we can often disempower ourselves. We don't use the resources that we have because, oh, it's my old karma, gum kao. It's my old karma. I can't get over it, or it's too obstructive, or you know, in this lifetime, it's never going to happen. It's like, if you think like that, it won't. But we can think differently. And that's, I feel, is one of the enormously powerful and beautiful things about the Buddha's teaching. It's a teaching of self-reliance. It's a kind of a teaching for grown-ups, I'd say. It's that you're taking responsibility for your own life and making your own choices. So I take... Oh, okay, one more. Yes, one last one. I'm not very good at short answers. You might have noticed.
I struggle to understand how you can stick to the precept of thou shalt not kill if you eat meat.
Well, the precept is about killing, so that if people ask me, I encourage vegetarian food. But if people don't ask, then I don't make any kind of judgment about it. The Buddha made a very clear distinction about, say, for the monastic community, that unless you see, hear, or suspect that some animal or bird or fish has been killed especially to be given to the Sangha, then you should accept it. And that because it's being offered to you as good food, and that people are offering it with a faithful heart. If you see or hear or suspect that they've killed it especially to give to the monastic community, then you must refuse it and say, you know, you can't accept things being killed for the monastery. But if it's something that has died already and the people are just sharing it with you, then you're obligated to accept it with appreciation. You don't have to eat it, but you should respect the kindness and the thoughtfulness that they're offering it to you. So it's a very common question. So you're by no means the first person to ask that. But there is a difference between, say, taking a knife and cutting the throat of a cow, and having a mouthful of beef burger. The mind state of putting some food into your mouth is very different from seeing a living animal and deliberately taking its life. Many people would say, "Well, it's the same thing, Ajahn," and they have done. But if I would say, just from my own experience and from the Buddha's perspective on it, he'd say, "No, it's not the same. At least from the Buddha's take on things, it's not the same because the kind of closing of your heart that has to happen in order to deliberately take the life of another creature is not the same as eating some food that's been given to you. It depends. I mean, it's not saying everyone has to think this way, but from the Buddha's perspective, he is saying it's not the same mind state. It's far more extremely destructive and harmful to deliberately take the life of another creature. I feel that the world could probably survive very happily on a vegetarian diet, and probably would be a lot healthier on account of that. But also, as Ajahn Chah, who's a genius of making these very succinct but all-encompassing statements, he said, "Where there's food, there's trouble." People have very, very strong opinions about it. So someone else might be here saying, "No, it's totally different. I'm a dedicated Buddhist. I keep the precepts really strictly, and I eat meat every day. It's not the same." And somebody else, like yourself, might think, "But no, it's exactly the same." So opinions get very strong around food, money, sex, property. So we have very strict rules around all those areas because it kind of goes straight to the reptile brain. You know, we have very strong reactive instincts around those areas. So it's important to respect the opinions that people have. And so that the traditions that different Buddhist countries have, you know, vary. So in China, you know, monasteries are very, very strictly vegetarians because they've inherited that as the sort of the standard model. That's not the same in Southeast Asia, like in Sri Lanka or Thailand, Burma. It sort of came straight from the sort of Buddhist tradition in India. In China, it went sort of through the Brahminical tradition. So it's got the kind of strict vegetarian model that you have in China for the Buddhists actually came through the Brahmin dietary restrictions, so they say. So it's I think it's important to be aware of your own opinions and be alert to not judging others, pro or anti. And just if people ask you to share freely what your perspective on food is, but to not create more suffering within yourself on account of the choices that other people make. Okay, I think that's enough for today. So thank you all for your very good attention.